We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on today with Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. On to another day where we get to discuss unsolved mysteries and these really big stories. This is a huge, huge episode. When I chose it for star power, and I really didn't at the time realize that we would probably be focusing more on the stories that are not related to celebrity.
Absolutely. I actually caught this episode a few weeks ago just watching Unsolved Mysteries, and I turned to Jack, my husband, and I said, I guarantee you Mark is going to pick this episode.
It's such a typical episode for him.
Well, you know, it's just so, like, a lot of gun talk, and you know your gun stuff.
No, you know your gun stuff, because it's like, I had nothing to add, but also Unsolved Mysteries did such a great job at explaining precisely what we are going to be covering.
Absolutely. They had graphics. Like, they gave me everything I needed to know.
Yeah. A little too much. Like, we know, we now have a type of tutorial on making blanks, if you really think about it. All you really need is maybe a vise, a pair of pliers, and that's it, and a gun.
Well, it didn't end spectacularly for the people involved in this case, so.
That doesn't stop people, though.
True.
But I did look a little bit more into, you know, blanks and dummy bullets and other accidents that have happened. But what episode are we talking about today?
We are talking about season 8, episode 1, and we're going to be talking about a lot of graphics and pictures and stuff like that. So if you want to see them while you're listening, you can follow us at Unsolved Mysteries Rewind on Facebook, and we post all pictures, GIFs, websites, everything we talk about here, basically.
It's really probably the best group on Facebook, period.
I think, yeah.
Because the bottom line is this. We do the deep dives for you, so you really don't have to worry about it. So you come to us when you want more to the story. And I think that's part of the problem with Unsolved Mysteries. It really leaves you wanting to know more. And I think that's where your, I almost called it obsession, but I think your love affair with Unsolved Mysteries. Because the story kind of ends 20 years ago, but there's so much more that has happened since.
Absolutely. And there's a few cases where they'll spend 4 minutes on a story. And once I start deep diving, I mean, I'm not kidding you, I'll spend like 8 hours researching a story. It's crazy.
We will figure a way to put your notes into a form where people can search it and read through, because
oh, cool.
It's crazy. I mean, it is really, really not crazy. I have to use a different word for crazy. It's so in depth and it's so complete that, yeah, I think it just gives such a wonderful overview and a really great update.
It is the ramblings of a madwoman. I understand.
You figured a way to write your ramblings, and I just, you know, I verbally spew mine. So this is why we have such good rapport.
Makes good team.
We are fully unbalanced. Well, welcome to the show. If you're listening for the first time, you can, and you like what you're listening, please go to iTunes or wherever you can leave a review and do that, or just send it to a friend of yours who might like Unsolved Mysteries. Everyone is kind of at home. They're sometimes very bored. And I think that our show really provides really easy entertainment, and it's not going to, Well, you know what? I was going to say it's not going to scare you, but I think a lot of our episodes and a lot of things that you've dug up do frighten me a bit, but in a good way.
Me too.
It's more interesting. Yeah. And it's more, it's really amazing. But so far, I don't think we've covered anything that is keeping me up at night. Not that we've released.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll see how you feel at the end of this episode. I will say that because of a story on this episode, I bought 4 security cameras for my house.
Did you really?
I really did. And I'll get to it because I have a whole feminist rampage I'll go on. But it's okay. It'll be fun. It'll be funny. I'm not that crazy. Just give us a try. Give us a listen.
Well, it's funny you say that because I happen to have this promo code, UM3. No, I'm kidding.
No, he's lying.
I was going to point out that I do also, we have security cameras in our house. And I'm going to mention which ones I use because it's not sponsored by them. I just love the company. It's called Blink. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. They're wireless cameras, and they take batteries, which is weird. The batteries last about a year. Hmm. And it's all Wi-Fi, and Amazon bought them. So if you have a Fire Stick TV, you can just say, show me the, you know, whatever you name the camera, and it will show you on your TV.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so Amazon can watch at any time. Oh, boy. That's going to be a whole other episode, isn't it?
Seriously.
But no, not sponsored. But Blink cameras are pretty cool. But cameras, I think, are just a necessary thing to have these days.
Yeah, for sure. And just, okay. Well, I'll cross that bridge when I get there.
There's your California. for sure. All right. California and Florida. So we're talking about Brandon Lee. We're talking about his last movie was The Crow. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see The Crow?
No, but I've definitely been aware of this whole thing since I was like a morbid teen clicking on, weird things that have happened in Hollywood.
But The Crow was something that the goth kids got into. And had a lot of friends who were like, oh, The Crow. I've never watched it. I have no problem with Brandon Lee or Bruce Lee. I just, I never had an interest in it. But he, it was a real tragic thing. You know, Brandon Lee was really kind of, I think anyway, an up-and-coming actor in the early 90s. The son of the legendary Bruce Lee, who of course passed away in 1973.
Yeah, at the age of only 32, very young.
Yeah, it's a very sad type of scenario. They also looked a lot alike. Of course, Brandon being only half Asian, he looked like his father, but like, just less Asian. It's a weird way. It was a very handsome guy. They're both very good looking guys, very like in shape, very physical, and very much into martial arts.
Yeah, exactly. Brandon's following not just a movie star, but he is like into martial arts, just like his dad was. And, please.
No, I was going to say, and he seemed to be following the same exact path. He studied martial arts, and he just, I believe he also studied drama at the same time. He really had a focus of following his father's footsteps.
Yeah, and sadly, he followed him a little too closely because they both died very young, and they both died, like, on the verge of becoming stars.
No, that's kind of, like, where the easy part of the story just ends, right? I mean, Brandon Lee was killed accidentally while on set for The Crow, I believe it was The Crow, where we get into a bit of a diversion from everything because we start talking about dummy bullets and blanks.
Yeah.
And I never really thought about dummy bullets and blanks. And there's also the, I think blanks are used in, you know, like starter guns. Not 100% sure about that, but it's basically just, you know, for movies, obviously you're not going to use live ammo.
Sure.
you never know. So we go down this weird path of needing to use either a dummy bullet or a blank. A blank is essentially a bullet, without the slug in it. It, I believe it has a piece of paper that holds
cardboard.
It holds the gunpowder in. And the gunpowder is surrounded by, and I'm not 100% sure about this, a type of chemical that's kind of like the igniter.
Okay.
And that's the number one problem because I think it's like powder coated on the inside so that when you strike the pin or when the pin strikes the bullet, it creates probably a spark and that spark ignites the something, the primer, which is what they call, and that creates the explosion, which sends the slug flying. You know, do you want to talk a little bit about that? Or?
Yeah. Well, something before we get to bullets is that they kind of posit the idea that maybe they were killed by feng shui, which was really bizarre. But something that was interesting is in Hong Kong, I guess Bruce Lee's house was, quote, spiritually misaligned. So they had a feng shui expert come in. This is before he moved. The feng shui expert was like, oh, this house is not good for feng shui. So he put like a mirror on the outside of the house to deflect any evil spirits that were going to come in.
Yeah.
On July 19th, one day before Bruce Lee dies, a typhoon comes and takes that mirror away. So that's kind of fun. I like that. That's like the unsolved mysteries of it all, because for the rest of it, it's not an unexplained death. It's not an unsolved mystery. Like, we have very clearly how the bullet went into Brandon Lee, but it's just spooky because they refer to it as like links in the chain. If this didn't happen, then this wouldn't have happened. If this wouldn't have happened, then that wouldn't have happened. And there's so many people that made wrong turns that ended up in Brandon Lee being accidentally shot. It's so sad.
Yeah, it is. Now with feng shui, or how do they pronounce it in this episode?
They called it like,
feng shui.
They called it feng shi.
Yes. I guess there's different dialects. Maybe I'm not really 100% sure about that.
Sure.
You know, I've been around feng shui forever. So, and it's one of these things I take into consideration whenever I'm designing something or if I'm putting something together. It's just something that I've known a lot of people who somehow they make a living doing this. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of there being something negative from poorly done feng shui. And I've never heard of it helping keep curses away or anything evil. Yeah. It's always been about basically taking whatever space you're in and finding the balance, regardless. And I'm clearing my throat like crazy. The mirrors are essentially something where mirrors are a strange thing. Yeah, you know this. It's and mirrors in feng shui are there to add balance to a room that's completely unbalanced. Because it multiplies things, obviously. I've read somewhere just this morning that people were calling it's like the aspirin of feng shui. it's really just finding harmony and balance, and that's it. So
yeah,
I don't give too much credence. I also don't like the idea of mirrors on the outside of my house. There's something about that makes me uncomfortable. Like, I don't understand why, and it's totally new to me in the past few hours. But I thought about it, and I don't think I would want a mirror on the outside of my house. It makes me uncomfortable. So maybe I read it somewhere. I'm not really, it's freaky, right? Like, it makes no sense. It's very strange. It's like a new thing. It's like the beginning of a new illness in my mind. But mirror, when I saw it, like, they show the reenactment, they show this little mirror, and it reminds me of one of these feng shui frames where you might see in a lot of Chinese, like, a lot of restaurants have this kind of decor where it just looks like the yin-yang kind of symbol, and sometimes in the middle there's a mirror, or it has this kind of octagon shape, and it's like gold leaf. You know, I do feel that the symbology is very, very powerful. It's just I don't feel like it's going to ward off evil. That's all. And I don't believe in curses, so.
I do, because it's fun. I like to keep that avenue open. But I don't think that's what happened in this scenario. It's unfortunate, but I mean, they say that either feng shui or a curse, like, killed Bruce Lee's older brother, it killed Bruce Lee, and it killed Brandon Lee. But that's such a stretch. This happened over probably 40 years. Only these three people.
And his sister still around, right?
Shannon, Bruce Lee's daughter, Brandon's sister, still around. His mom's still around. So, yeah, I don't necessarily believe in that. I think that was a little too convenient. But what we do get into is we meet these two detectives, Detective Brian Pettis and Detective Rodney Simmons. And they were the two who were in charge of the Brandon Lee onset death investigation.
Yeah.
Now, there was a pawn shop scene that they were filming for The Crow. And so two stagehands went to a local pawn shop and, like, cleared them out so that they would have a legitimate-looking pawn shop set. They grabbed this round, this box of, like, 44 round ammunition bullets.
Yeah, like 44 caliber.
A caliber, thank you. And so they have, they're setting up the pawn shop on set, and the stunt coordinator's like, what is this? This is live ammunition. What are you doing here? So he's like, this is ridiculous. This is not allowed on a movie set. So he takes the bullets and puts them in his car. They sit there for like 2 weeks. And apparently this is when we get into like the blanks and the dummy bullets. So they tell us Unsolved Mysteries. They have like very helpful little graphics. And they say that a blank is the bullet with the lead tip removed and it's replaced with a cardboard disc. So it still has the primer on the back and it still has the gunpowder. So the crew was supposed to have purchased blanks, but nobody bought the blanks. So they're like, ooh, you know what? In the stunt coordinator's car, we got those bullets. Let's just put them in a vise, pop the lead tip off, and empty out the gunpowder.
This is a low budget production, I'm assuming.
That is such a crazy thing. It has to be low budget or just lazy. I don't even know.
I mean, I'm not really sure. I think that the production was actually in North Carolina. I think that's where he died. So, I mean, it's possible. It wasn't so easy to find. I don't know where I'd buy blanks.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this is pre like internet and Amazon Prime coming to you in 2 days, which is fair, but it sounded like it was an oversight on their end. Now, they're also going to need dummy rounds. So dummy rounds is just the lead tip on the end, but there's no primer and there's no powder.
So you can load it on camera. And also, when you look at the front of a camera, you should be able to see the round. Like in a regular 38 snub nose type of thing, you'll see the barrel open. So
exactly.
If you had the fake ones, it'd be like, not that I would notice. I don't think I would notice that on screen, but of course, they're trying to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, now maybe I would. Now after that, I know all this kind of stuff.
Right.
So the prop guys continue this little like DIY project that by firing off, it totally like firing off all the blanks just to use up the primer. And the primer is like what starts the whole thing going on the actual bullet itself.
Right.
So they fire off and at least one of the primers did not get spent during that expedition.
But the primer is powerful. The primer,
yeah, the primer is powerful. You're going to get a spark.
I mean, it's enough to create a very excessive explosion. It's just not enough to launch a bullet. I don't know how far a bullet can run, but obviously bullets kill people. So
pretty far.
It's not the accelerant. It's the starter. And like I was saying that it's kind of like in a car when the car battery, you give the car battery a jolt to the engine to get it started to run on gas. You can't really blow up a car with gas, you know, like in the movies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the prop guys, they're like, they have to do a scene where we as the camera or in the audience are staring down the barrel of a gun. So they're firing. And two people hear like a pop and they're like, whoa, what was that about? They didn't realize that there was a primer in one and the primer had just enough oomph to it to dislodge the lead part of the bullet. And so the lead part of the bullet is just shoved in the barrel. It's like jammed in there. So instead of anybody investigating what that primer was or what that pop was, they're just like, oh, well, future us's problem. And they just put it aside for another 2 weeks.
2 weeks. It could have been, you know, it's just crazy to me that this would even happen.
Shaken loose. Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying. Like it's a link on a link on a link. And it's just like, wow, so many missteps here happened. Like Brandon Lee's time was up. All these things contributed to it. So they didn't check it. Two people heard the pop. So 2 weeks later, they're filming his character's death scene, Brandon Lee's character's death scene. So they loaded the gun with just the blanks, and the blanks are the ones with the cardboard in them and all the gunpowder in them. So they give it to the actor Michael Massey, and so he points it at Brandon Lee like he's supposed to do in the scene, and he pulls the trigger. And now that's only supposed to give like a flash to us, but because the lead tip was lodged in the barrel of the gun, it actually propels the bullet right into Brandon Lee's abdomen, and he is pronounced dead at the hospital.
And while I don't believe that this had the force of of a proper bullet. Sure. It must have had enough force to clearly have killed him.
Yeah, and I mean, he died of blood loss, and you just think of that entering his body, tumbling all around. It's got to be ripping things left and right in veins and arteries. I'm sure the blood loss was substantial.
It's a terrible thing. And this isn't the first time Hollywood had something like this happen. There was a famous thing that happened in 1984 with John Eric Hexum on the set of his TV show. And he was playing, for the scene, he was playing Russian roulette, or relay, whatever. And same exact thing, but the problem is that he did have a proper blank, but it had the cardboard in it. And the pressure alone, he put it right to the temple of his head. And the pressure that comes out of this bullet is still forceful enough to do damage. And it was, he went into like an immediate coma and passed away pretty quickly.
That's so sad. There's something really weird that it's actually in a Bruce Lee movie where they're filming something with blanks, and Bruce Lee's character says, like, that wad of cardboard, when it comes out, is enough to hurt you really bad. So it's just kind of like a weird, almost premonition.
This is why even a dirty gun, like if there's, you know, some type of matter in the, what do you call that? The nozzle. The barrel. It could harm you because, I mean, the force is bringing everything that's in there out.
Yeah.
So it's very sad.
They weren't able to press any charges because it went through so many people's hands. It was so much negligence that they're like, we can't pinpoint this to one person messing up because, like, six different people messed up. So, sadly, that's kind of where we leave the Brandon Lee story. He's buried right next to his dad. And, We head to Mason City, Iowa.
I do want to just say, this is an example, though, of something that's not really in that category of unsolved. I think, of course, they went down this little thing about the a mirror falling off your house and the whole family is now cursed. But no, not from that. But they create this kind of paranormal subtext. And I just think that this is really just an unfortunate thing that happened. That's all.
Absolutely. This could not be more solved, honestly. Like, we have exactly the path of the bullet for over 6 weeks. Like, they did a 6-month investigation into it. I think this one's solved.
No update.
Yeah. No update needed.
Now, one thing I did have a question is, did Brandon Lee have any children? Do you know?
No, but he was 18 days away from marrying his fiance. Yeah. Isn't that tragic?
That is tragic.
3 years they were together. I can't imagine her heartbreak.
Yeah. And, it's just, I couldn't imagine, you know, for something that's so avoidable, you know, like wearing your seatbelt or something. Mm. Like you were saying, we go down to Mason City, Iowa.
Iowa. Yeah. And this is actually the cute little city that inspired Music Man, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's just about this quaint little town named River City. And this is Mason City. This is what it's based off of. In 1990, the population was about 29,000. And we meet, like, fresh faced, wholesome as apple pie, Jody Huizentruit.
Yeah. And she's an up-and-comer in the town, I think. She's somebody who everybody knows. Everybody knows her face because she's the newscaster or news anchor. Mm-hmm. And she's, like you said, she's really, really this, like, perfect embodiment of just a sweet, pretty, very, very nice and personable person.
Quintessential girl next door, honestly.
She didn't show up to her job one morning.
Yeah, one morning, it's June, about 3 weeks after her 27th birthday, her producer calls her, because I guess sometimes she would sleep in. And her producer called and was like, hey, where are you? You're supposed to be on the news in an hour, and I'm kind of having to do both of our jobs for us, so wake up, sleepyhead. And yeah, she's like, oh.
I have a question about that. Didn't she say she called, did they mention what time that Amy Kunz called?
No, I think they said it, and I know what you're referring to, but I think they said it like at like 4, a little after 4. So I think you're right that it was after 4 a.m.
Okay.
She called her because she was supposed to be at the station at 4. So she called, and Jody's like, huh, what, where, you know? And she's like, wake up, it's time to go. So she's like, ah, God, I'll be there. I'm on my way. I'm just, let me grab a few things, my hair dryer, and I'll be out the door. So she didn't arrive still at 5, but the show must go on. You know, you must do the news. So Amy, her producer, actually has to take the desk. She does the show until 7. Once she gets off the air, it's about 7:13. She calls the police to do a wellness check because nobody has heard from Jody. And so the police go over there. We meet investigator Frank Stearns. The police go over there and they don't find anything amiss in her apartment, but they see her car. Her car is a red Mazda Miata, and there is her purse, her shoes outside of it, earrings, a hair dryer. Her key is bent on the ground, and it's all kind of like leading away from her car as if she was just grabbed.
Yeah, like something's up here. Like immediately you see that.
When I saw her shoe on the ground, it just broke my heart. Like, you know, no good is happening. And it paints such a picture.
Yeah, so, but you know what it also paints a picture of? And this is just me being me. But I've never known a woman to have a clean car. Sorry. And in the back seat of my wife's car, there are probably an odd number of shoes. Odd meaning there's a missing one, you know?
Okay.
I clean out her car about once a week, and it is like, what's wrong with you? You know, this car is disgusting. And like, it's just, you know, but so yeah, like I can, and one morning our car did get put in because she had failed to lock the car, and somebody, I guess, went by and went into the car, and there was all this stuff outside of it. And I'm like, it was just embarrassing because the car was such a mess that the person went through it all and threw it on the ground. They wouldn't have done all that if it wasn't so much garbage. So
yeah.
I'm just saying that if somebody looked at her car, my wife's car, they would have thought something along the same way. Because there were shoes outside of the car. There were wrappers and God knows what.
But was it like slowly trailing off into the woods?
It was because he grabbed a handful of it, whoever it was. Oh. Maybe it was a woman. And they were going through things and just throwing it on my neighbor's lawns as they're walking down the street. So, yeah.
So, in my situation,
yes. But my wife did not vanish that morning. So.
Right. And never to be seen from again. So they actually call the Mason City Police, calls the FBI and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. We are like dragging the river behind her house. People are searching on foot for her in the park behind her house. There was like several vacant acres of like a Civil War reenactment park right next to her house where she could have easily been found. So
you think they use blanks? I'm just kidding.
No, God. Well, somebody comes forward and they said, oh, you know what? I heard a woman scream around like 4-ish. So I looked outside and I saw a white Ford Econoline, the creepiest van of all time.
Yeah.
And I saw it with its lights running, and like it was running, but there was nobody in it. So this is now like, let's find out who has a white Ford Econoline. So all we really know is that information. We see Jody's sister and she comes out to say like she thinks Jody's still alive. But sadly, Jody was actually declared legally dead in 2001.
Right.
Now, this is where our deep dive comes in. So the information that I've gotten on this were mainly from 48 Hours, findjody.com, and a Reddit user named JTigerJail. So the first and like biggest suspect when you hear about this case would be Arthur John Van Sice. He threw a surprise birthday party for Jody and for another one of her friends named Annie. The night before she vanished, she went to John's house to watch a videotape of the surprise birthday party. So he comes to her apartment because he just happens to be driving by and he's like, oh my God, I was the last person to be seen with her alive.
Right. And in any movie, you will say, well, what do you mean? How do you know she's dead?
Yeah, exactly. How do you know you were the last person? And all we know is this is a disappearance. And,
another thing is if you believe she's dead, she probably was killed and that person is the last person to see her alive.
Exactly. If it's not you.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been called a longtime person of interest by the police in this case. They've actually twice dug his basement up looking for Jody's body.
Which is insane, right? In order to get the access to like your home or my home, they need to say, all right, well, Kim did it. And we have reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. So is there more to this, I wonder?
Well, he was he's a 50-year-old guy. She is like freshly 27, and he was obsessed with her. He named his boat after
That's
her.
That's almost me, right? In a couple of years, I'll be 50. That's oh me God, hanging yes. out with like a 27-year-old and saying, you know what? I'm going to name my boat. It's creepy.
It's
what
so
it is.
Creepy. He would like take her out like jet skiing with his son. And when he would see her, you know, be a 27-year-old and like dance and drink yeah. and be flirtatious, he was said to be like enraged about this because he was so obsessed with her. And actually, if you watch the 48 Hours interview, he just keeps saying like, she was the best. I loved her like a daughter, and just keeps referring to her in the past tense. So this guy is creepy, creepy, creepy. And he's like 6'4". She's like 5'2". And he could have easily grabbed her. Yeah. Now, the woman who reported hearing her screaming reports that she heard somebody say a woman scream along the lines of no, and then either Ron, John, or Sean. And Arthur John Van Cise actually only went by John.
Now, I can also understand that people don't like getting involved, right, into things. But,
yeah.
But I'll say this. In the middle of the night, if I hear somebody yelling or something, I'm going to investigate. I will give a random call to 911 if I think in a situation like this. Now, I'm in New York. I mean, it's very noisy here. This is Iowa. You know, this is not, you know, this is more, I guess, less populated. It's more community-based, I'm assuming. So I'm just thinking, why wouldn't this person at least investigate a little bit? I mean, she could just be somebody who's like, you know what, I'm not getting involved, and I'm afraid for my own life, maybe.
There's actually been about 5 or 6 different neighbors in this apartment complex who say they either heard something or saw something that morning around the same time that should have rose suspicions, you know? But, you know, it's that, I believe it's like Kitty Genovese story where if you are in an apartment, you have diminished responsibility because you just think somebody else will take care of it. What yeah. am I going to do? I'm only one person. There's 20 other apartments around here. I'm sure one of them's called it. I don't want to overwhelm the police, yeah, you know? Right. So you actually get, the more people you're around, the less responsibility you feel to take care of other people.
Right.
So, let's see. In 2017, a warrant was actually issued to search two of Van Cise's cars.
Isn't this weird, though? I mean, this is so far from the time that...
Yes, she disappeared in 95.
Right. I mean, we're talking, you know, a lifetime later. It's very yeah. strange to me. And what kind of evidence could be retained for over 20 years?
I don't know. Maybe DNA. DNA's not what it used to be in 95.
And he still has this car? I mean...
No, that's the weird thing, is actually they searched because he's not very smart, I'll say. And he went to findjody.com and put out there what the search warrants were for. He actually put copies
no,
of them on there.
No, really? Yeah. So he's kind of an attention whore.
Yeah, or, you know, like, kind of like maybe possibly somebody who did it would kind of want to put themselves in the middle of the case, just speculating here.
Yeah, well, you know, this is another thing, is that, I believe in psychology. It comes up from time to time again. It's the truth always wants to come out. And even subconsciously, you're going to slip up and you're kind of going to realize it. And it's about like kind of that giving hints and not even realizing that you're giving hints. And I don't know. These are telltale signs to me.
Yeah, and so when he posted it, actually, it was for two cars. One was like a 97, so it couldn't have been around at the time. And one was like a 2010 car. And they actually, it was to pull GPS information from these cars. And he was also ordered to give another DNA and a handprint and a fingerprint to the Iowa people. So he complies and he goes and does that, and we haven't heard anything else. But if it's GPS info, I'm wondering, are they thinking he's going back and visiting where maybe her body might be?
Right. And I also think, is it the body is yet to be recovered, right?
No, we have no idea what happened to her.
Now, I mean, I guess it's possible that they're thinking maybe he's transporting the body at some period of time. And I think that might be like kind of like he went to a weird warehouse and picked up a rug, you know. I'm laughing. I'm not really laughing. I think that this is the worst. And
it's out of uncomfortableness. Yes. I totally get
all of my laughing, usually 90% of the time, it's because I'm uncomfortable. Or I just sympathize with this situation. I cannot believe that somebody would be so horrible. And
now,
I think that might be it. I think there may be like, hey, what is he doing going between point A and point B? Let's go and pull any type of DNA that might be in that car.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was specifically for the GPS data, though. They did specifically for his DNA on his person, but they specifically wanted the GPS coordinates, like information for where his cars had been. Now, this is what made me profoundly sad and filled me with a feminist rage, because this woman, and this is every woman, this woman is trying to just do her thing, go out there, be successful, be on the news.
And
she is surrounded by men who want to take that from her. Like, she is just surrounded, because she is a woman and because she has a vagina, she is just surrounded by men who want to victimize her. Because trust me when I say that John is not the last suspect that we have, not the only suspect that we have. She was surrounded by people who were creepy as hell. And like, she would get letters. She was stopped when she was out jogging one day by a dark colored vehicle with no headlights on. She was sent via letters to her job, as well as many other news reporter women in Iowa, with like decapitated heads in the margins and saying like, I'm gonna rape you and cut your body up and they'll never find you, but I'll send your head to your news station. Like, this is just because they're women, and that makes me weep for womankind.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that this, I mean, her crime was that she was attractive. And she was a personal figure. I mean, a public figure, and she was personable in front of the camera. Yep. And in that sense, stalking is one of these creepy things, and it's a very dangerous thing. I'm sure that you remember the story, My Sister Sam TV show, Rebecca Schaefer, how she was murdered by a stalker. And you know what? These are two tiny, isolated cases. I'm sure we both know. I can't say for you, but I'm sure we both know, or I know, men who are just kind of are not to the point of murdering, but they're kind of a little too much for the world in that sense, where they're just a little too obsessed about things. And
let me throw a depressing stat out at you. 1 in 8 women will be stalked in her lifetime.
Yeah. And we're probably going to be talking about quite a number of them in the future. And it's a real shame that this becomes a discussion about a cautionary tale of not, you know, it's a single woman who, you know, I could not imagine being a single woman in this situation and being asked out like on a date, like, hey, you want to go out to dinner? And probably having a little bit in the back of your mind thinking, is he going to cut me up and kill me? And like, you know, because maybe he's just a stalker.
When I was a single woman before I got with my husband, I would always give the person's information and where we would be going to a friend just in case I got murdered. Now, granted, I am a bit of a weirdo that's like watched Forensic Files since I was like a tween, but it's always in the back of your mind. Like, it's always a possibility. And this is why I got security cameras, because I was like, at least if I get murdered, we can avenge who did it. But if I could just quickly run through the other suspects.
Yes. And I think that there's something there with these guys, too. But they might have just been stalkers that didn't take it to this level. Or maybe they did. Like, I don't know.
And I'm not trying to call you out, but just the way that you say they could just be stalkers.
I know.
Isn't that horrible? I know. I'm not trying to call you out, but I know what you mean. But like, oh, God.
Well, nowadays, here's the thing. It's so easy to stalk somebody these days. All you really, I mean, you need Google or whatever, and you can find out so much about somebody, and it's a little bit scary. Back in these days, you know, it was very difficult. What did you have, really? The white pages? Yeah. You can find out where somebody lives, and then what?
A windowless van.
A windowless van. So, but yeah, I really don't mean to make it sound like it's not a major thing, but I will say that this is your typical creepy, like, wacko, right? So... And I'll just say, my word, he's a wacko. Could have been harmless. I don't know. Like, he just might have been just really creepy.
Well, if he was harmless to Jody, he wasn't harmless to other people. He is a serial rapist. He has raped his 8-year-old daughter. He was obsessed with Jody. Whenever she would come on the news, he would be like, oh, my girl, like reading the news. So he happened to have a fort a Fort, a white Ford Econoline van, and the back was actually filled with like sex toys, lubricants, handcuffs. They called it a poor man's porn palace. So shortly after Jody's disappearance, he gave the Econoline to a friend and said, "Oh, there's evidence of sexual activity in the van." And the friend's like, "I got you. Say no more." And burns the van. So all evidence is completely gone from the van.
Right.
Now, when he actually is on trial for the rape of his 8-year-old daughter, somebody casually mentioned Mason City and he just smiled and said, "Jody, who's in Truett?" So the person, the agent of the court who was talking to him was like, "Oh yeah, I don't think she's alive anymore." And he said, "Nope, she's dead." What the heck is that about?
Yeah. It's a very matter of fact. It's one of those type of things that I think that this guy did a lot of things and we're not really, it's funny because when I just made a comment, I was looking at a different section of your notes, oddly enough. So I didn't see I don't know. It didn't click to me, his past. So yeah, when I'm saying that he was, harmless, I'm thinking in this particular case, but he is, all of this stuff really, it equates to being so creepy and it equates to him and his comment there is just so obvious that if he knows about something, or rather, if he's involved in this, he really seems to know a lot about it. But he might also still be just obsessed with the situation.
Yeah, exactly. If he's like some kind of creeper who's like watching the news a little too closely and somebody said Mason City, he might be like, "Oh yeah, Jody, who's in Truett?" But I don't know. It is suspicious. But, you know, we can't talk about Jody Who's in Truett without talking about everybody's favorite police corruption.
Oh, my God. It always seems to be, not always, but there does seem to be a lot of police corruption in this country.
The ones that you and I do, I'm seeing it more and more. So she was actually rumored to be doing an investigative report on police corruption in Mason City. Now, Mason City is a little notorious for police corruption. There's a story that I read through the rumor mill that in the summer of 1999, a man named Gerald Bess went to his preacher and told him that he believes that the police were actually involved in criminal activities and that they might have killed Jody to try and cover up the misconduct that they were doing. And then later that year, he was found very suspiciously murdered. His murder has never been solved. Now, a Find Jody billboard was erected on her, what would have been her 50th birthday. And it just said something like, "Somebody knows something, is it you?" It was vandalized overnight. And the vandalized, you know, what it says on there in graffiti says Frank Stearns Machine Shed. Now, Frank Stearns is the investigator on Jody's case who we met in this episode of Unsolved Mysteries.
Now, here's the thing. Did anybody go to maybe his shed?
I mean, it's all still under Mason City control. So I don't think that we're going to get any answers until we get an outside an outside source. They should have handed this over when all of this information came out about police misconduct, because they're not going to be able to do an actual investigation. There's more police corruption because the former police chief had Jody's diary, and one day it just shows up at this newspaper, like photocopied the pages of her diary. And they're like, "I wonder who sent this." They're able to track it down. It was his wife who he was allegedly abusive to. And she just made photocopies of it and just sent it on out there to everybody. So it's like, what is going on here? Is she trying to tell us something? Like, it's very weird. And I don't know. Police corruption really is probably the scariest thing we can even talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because it's one of those things that's so well hidden. You know, these are the people who probably know best on how to cover up something.
And if they can't help you, who will, you know?
I do have
two quick
questions on what you thought about this. When they had originally called the police that she was missing, that Jody was missing, do you think the police would really investigate this and do a wellness visit after just a few hours?
I do, because she was a pretty white woman. And I think that it was 1995 and they were just like, we better see what's going on. Now, if it was an African-American man and somebody needed a wellness check in Mason City, Iowa in 1995, I don't think they would have just done it after a few hours. But I do think they would have done it in this.
Well,
case.
What would that guy be doing there? Black. No.
Exactly.
So, no, but I agree with you. And she's also a celebrity of the town, maybe. So maybe in that sense, And the other thing is, in the 48 hours video, I wrote this in the notes. I just thought that the comment, I don't know why it kind of rubbed me wrong, but when they show all of her hats, his weird comment of nice hats, and they're just so casual about it.
In 48 hours, what Mark's referring to, we see like a police camera footage of them going through Jody's apartment, like room for room. And we'll post a link to that on our Facebook page. But there is we see a hat rack and the guy's just like, ooh.
And her
nice
golf
hats.
Clubs. And it's like, she's obviously very active. I have golf clubs. I can't play golf.
At best, it was flippant. At worst, it was creepy. Like, it was weird.
It was also very relaxed. It was like, and I'm wondering at what point was that video made? I mean, this is the beginning of the investigation of a real missing person. It just seemed a little too casual, in my opinion.
It's definitely within days.
Yeah.
So
big messy, huh? Big messy apartment.
A little bit messy. It was a little bit messy. And I was like, you go, girl. You got your career. You got your golf. I was like, I don't know. I just really relate to her. I see her little wholesome little face and I just... Oh, it breaks my heart.
But I look at that apartment and I think about her car. So.
Oh my God. Well, if you think that's a messy apartment, don't come to my house.
No. I'm not judging anyone either because it's like, obviously, you know, I do believe, you know, she was horribly murdered. It's just crazy to me to see these things as well. Like when I see somebody's apartment like this and it's really heartbreaking because we see her closet and this is just her everyday life. And she just, you know, it's like a little apartment. It's not like she had a lot of money. You know, she was probably just starting to make a few bucks. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's really heartbreaking. There's also three toothbrushes. I know you pointed that out.
And the toilet seat was up.
Not in the video that I saw, though.
Oh, well, that's what I've read. Okay. But yeah. I don't know. Maybe the police, I don't know, put it down or something. But, and she could have been cleaning it. Who knows? Because her house was like mildly messy. But, you know, she was just going to work for the morning. She overslept. She was running out the door. And she probably was going to clean it when she got back. So it's just a trip to see because it is a moment frozen in time in her life. And, wow, it's so scary.
Do we know where she lived, actually?
She lived in the Keys Apartments in Mason City.
Were there a lot of apartments?
I'd say 10.
Because those kind of apartments, I mean, the walls are paper thin. I would just imagine it would be more than one person hearing somebody yell at 4 in the morning.
Well, they did. Remember, I was saying like 5 or 6
people. Oh, really?
People.
All right. I missed that. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. No, yeah. 5 or 6 people heard it. And that's when we're talking about like diminished responsibility and stuff. But so finally, just to close out this suspect pool, we have Tony Jackson. Tony Jackson is an area rapist. He is serving life for being a serial rapist in Iowa. He actually lived only 2 blocks away from where she worked. The whole reason that we're suspecting him is because his former cellie claims that he wrote a prison rap about the crime. And he had a lyric in there that said that Jody was, quote, stiffen in Tiffin, when Tiffin is a small little town in Iowa, which was about 158 miles away from Mason City. So they sent cadaver dogs out there, police out there to search for her body. They didn't find anything, but 2 out of 3 cadaver dogs did hit on human decomposition. So at some point, there was definitely a human body that was dead there. But
why investigate further, right? It's so weird to me. It's like, all right, well, the dog smelled human decomposition.
Yeah, and it's 1995 again. You know, it's not it's just different. But I went through like his whole laundry list of crimes, and he's a home invader all the way. He's not like, let me just grab this woman off the street. He was a horrible rapist and a terrible person. But I don't see him for this crime. And plus, in jail, a lot of guys are like, oh yeah, that's super high profile case. Yeah, I did it, aren't I? Like, you know, Mr. Tough Guy. So there's a lot of bragging that goes on.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that the TV station that she worked for, Planet of Trainer Honor, it's still there. It's very nice. And I think that she really left her mark on this little town.
And if we ever hear anything about her, any updates, you can bet we're going to bring you the updates.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if we will ever hear about anything. And I really, really hope it's not because somebody's putting a pool in that guy's house and they dig up the shed.
Yeah. But you know what? Like at this point, she's legally declared dead. Her mom's died. Her sisters are a lot older than her and she's getting up there. I think people just want closure. I think that everybody knows she's dead. And I think having a body would be better than having no body.
Well, the reason why I say I hope they don't find it there is because it's so obvious. Why wouldn't they just check?
You're talking about John?
Yeah, the shed, suspect? The machine shed.
Oh, Frank, yeah, the investigator, yeah.
I don't know. It's just, there seems also, it's possible that more than one person is involved in this.
Yeah, it's just sad. It just, honestly, it just makes me sad to be a woman because you are vulnerable at every turn.
And Unsolved Mysteries really does touch upon a lot of these situations where women are the focus of the attack. I mean, it's probably statistically speaking more common, far more common. But
yeah.
Going to our next story, it's another situation where a young girl and her boyfriend get into a situation of pregnancy, and they have to make that really tough decision of giving up the child.
It's not even really their decision. It's kind of her parents' decision of, like, you're 16, you're not going to keep this child.
Yeah, and it's a real... I couldn't imagine making this decision. No. I think that... I was born in 73, so, I mean, this is about... whoever this would be about my age right now, you know, adopted. And there is an update, of course. You've dug as deep as possible.
Yeah.
She's basically being told, you're giving up the child. Her father is very, very upset with...
It's like, you're a disappointment to the family. How could I ever love you? Like, oh, it's harsh.
It's like, yeah, you know, it's tough, but it's not the end of the world, buddy.
Yeah, teens are gonna have sex, and like you said, it's not the end of the world. They said, of course, any parent would be disappointed and angry, but just... Right. I know it's not 1973, 1974 anymore, but oh my gosh.
No, but I mean, really Woodstock harsh. Was just 4 years ago. I mean, it's not like we're living, it's not as though we live in a world where people are not sexually active. It's, it's a part of the modern, culture of the early 70s. And I mean, part of the modern culture of all time. It's just very, very public that people are sexually active. It's just, it's just one of those things.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And of course, I could go on another feminist rant about, female Preach. Sexuality and how that's not accepted. Yeah. Preach, sister. But it reminds me of a Sopranos line where she's like, Dad, it's the 90s. Parents are supposed to talk about sex with their kids. And he goes, it might be 1990 out there, but in this house, it is 1954. Like, we do not talk about that. And that, I feel like, is just such a dad line.
Yeah. We're pretty open, like, with my son. Like, we talk, I mean, he's only 11. We don't talk about much. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he's got, he has, like, a little girlfriend. You know, it's, like, one of those things. And it's just, today kids are just so much more advanced. Like, I think we spoke about this before. Like, when having access to Google in general is very scary, I think, for a child. I mean, you grow up with it. It's just.
Yeah, but I grew up not quite like it is now. No. Like, I don't know. I was a lot more sheltered, I think, too. But
you didn't have Snapchat. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I didn't have Snapchat. But I remember being specifically. Oh, my God. My mom is going to cry if she hears this. Mom, turn this off. But I remember being on a chat program called MIRC.
Yeah,
when I, was a
I remember IRC.
Old.
I still remember my number. 378-5789.
Well, I was 6 years old, and I remember I would go on there for like typing practice, and I'd
oh
be
boy,
like,
did I just give out my number in a creepy conversation? Uh-oh. Sorry. Go on.
I was like, I live in California. My name is Kim. When I was like six, and I remember this guy like straight accosting me, and I was just like, I'm 6 years old, and the words he said to me, I still remember to this day. He said, "Old enough to talk, old enough for cock."
Oh my God.
That's what he said to me when I was 6 years old on the internet. So
was not
me. I guess I didn't grow up super sheltered. I'm going to pull up those chat logs and see what the number
I got to go.
No, Mark's not a
creep. No. I don't think I am. But people are creepy assholes. That's the bottom line. But it's also that's a perfect indication. That's the early aspect of where things went and now it's there. And, it's a different world, but people were having sex and having children way before the internet.
Oh yeah.
And they weren't married, but they gave up the child, and it was a very heartbreaking scene, the reenactment. She's having this pregnancy, and she's, the end result, of course, having the baby is going to just, the whole thing is just very sad and it's just depressing.
And Robert Stack says, and I quote, "Giving birth was a lonely labor destined to end in disappointment."
Yeah.
And she's like, oh my God.
She won't even look at the, or they won't show her the baby.
Yeah, they whisk the baby right away and some guy comes in. He's like, "Hey there, sweetheart, why don't you sign on the dotted line?" She goes, can I just have a second to think about it? He goes, "Nope, afraid not. Go ahead, sign me."
I believe like, that's how they are. I'm going to bed because, you know, on one hand, I just feel like, all right, well, you know, it is still your choice. You can keep this kid. But, you know, but I understand. It's just the whole thing. Because, you know, he's waiting. He's got a family who's on hold right now on his big old cell phone, probably. Oh, no, it's 1974 at this point. So there's no cell phone. So, but he has somebody waiting to get that, like, all right, the kid's yours.
Yeah, and you have a hormonal, confused teen who's told if she keeps the baby, she can't go back home. So he's like, don't even think another minute about this. Like, it's so slimy, but he has to just weasel his way in there before she even has a chance to think if she wants to change her mind.
Yeah, he's real sleazy.
Yeah, real sleazy. So the baby goes up for adoption, and Dave, who I think to date wins the award for oldest looking reenactor for a teenager, because this guy looks 45 years old, and he's supposed to be 18, and we will be posting a picture of that.
He looks like Chris Elliott. I don't know if you know Chris Elliott.
Chris Elliott with the shortest jean shorts you've ever seen.
Yes. My wife was watching, and she's like, wait, is that the real guy with the wig on? And we were one. Yeah, I'm like, no, he's too skinny. He's too skinny. But it was like, yeah, I mean, he's got this guy who they got had to have been somebody's nephew or grandfather.
Or grandfather. Yeah. Jinx, yeah.
So, yeah, exactly. I mean, it was very, very, I love that kind of stuff. I just think it's so funny. And his hair is so bad.
I know. And we need some levity in this episode. So I'll take it wherever I can get it. But they both move on. They get married to different people. They have kids. They get divorced. And
that's the end, right? It's over. Well, they go in their own separate ways and they move on.
1995 rolls around and it's time for a high school reunion. So they actually reconnect, and within a year they are married to each other because they love each other still.
They are so cute together. Seriously.
Yeah. His little face when he's smiling. Oh, sorry.
No. I just want to say, like, it's really just her talking the whole time, the mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, she seems like a normal woman. And they pull back and you see that she's sitting next to her now husband, who is like her, you know, first love type of situation. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, there's something about that that really made me think that's really sweet. Would never be me because I dated lunatics, but it's one of these situations where they have this connection of having a child together. That has to be something where you have to carry that for your life, right? I mean, I would imagine that, you know, separating at such a young age, it's got to be very emotionally damaging. But to get back together, there's something really sweet about that. There's something really magical.
I know. I love it too. And there is something called trauma bonding, where if you both go through something horrific together, like, you know, being forced to put your baby up for adoption, that you two are just like connected for life, basically. But the fact that they were married to other people and it never worked, and then they found each other, and I looked them up and they're still married today. It's so sweet. And so he's actually a special education teacher. She is a correctional officer. And guess what the big twist is here, people?
Dun, dun, dun.
They met in Mason City, Iowa.
And I want to know if they have a shed.
Oh my God. I told Jack, I was like, they could be suspects for all we know. Like, seriously, we don't know who did this. So, well, in 95, they were getting married. So, but they were in Mason City. And update, they found their daughter. Everybody looks happy to know each other.
All we get is a single picture, which I felt like, yeah, you could have done a little bit more than that.
But the daughter is looking at her mother with like such love in her eyes. It's just such a cute freeze frame. We will post that.
We talk about adoption a lot on this show. And it's one of these things I've said in the past. It's something I really think is probably the best thing you can do for somebody. One of the best things. And I love talking about these horrible, horrible things. And then we talk about a sweet situation where, wow, you got the family back together.
It gives me hope. Tempers my mood. Yeah, exactly. if it was all down, oh, I would be depressed. So I'm glad we have little uplifting stories like this. But because it's Unsolved Mysteries, we are soon back down again.
You know, it's like going to, it's like making a mixtape. You got to have the sad ones and the happy ones, and you got to get people on the dance floor. And
yeah,
we're back to slow dancing at this point.
Got to manipulate those emotions.
Yeah. So this one, it's a wanted situation. Antonio Tony Castro. My favorite.
Shasta, California.
My favorite of the reenactors. This is a big budget reenactment.
I would like a IMDb for the reenactors, and I'm not kidding, because this guy killed it.
Mm-hmm. He also looked a lot like Tony Castro.
Yeah, and when I know we'll get to it, but when he's like talking to that lady about the car,
yeah,
there was such like tension and chemistry in that scene. I was like, what is going to happen? I don't know.
Yeah, I have to. I just watched it again this morning, and I was just like, you know, they really went on location for this one. They have streams, yeah, and it's really, really a fun. It's a really dramatic reenactment. But yeah, he's a Mexican national with a long rap sheet of violent offenses. He walked. Now, maybe you can remind me, how did his story begin here?
We start because there's a man in an SUV and he looks behind him and there is a police officer following him. Now, 3 days before we're on this officer tailing this guy, the guy Castro, who's in the Suburban, actually like stabbed and beat this guy who was just doing repairs on this empty house. And just before that, he actually murdered this 72-year-old paralyzed war veteran, which is like one of the scummiest things I've ever heard of.
Sure.
His name is Mike Fudeth, and he was actually murdered in his farmhouse. So Castro is the prime suspect of that. And Castro just so happens to be driving that guy's car right at this moment, the Mike Fudeth.
Yeah, he's a very smart guy. You know, he's,
yeah,
let me steal like a car that has plates on it that are attached to the person who was just murdered.
Exactly. And, you know, he took all of his guns. And so we're back on the chase. He is armed to the teeth. And it's not even really a chase. He's just kind of following the guy. And so the SUV is like, I'm going to take this exit just to see if the cop's like really following
me. Are you ever in this situation where you have a cop behind you?
All the time.
Oh my, I have the most guilty conscience. So I'm like, I'm not doing anything wrong. And it's just, I feel like I'm a murderer. You know, I'm the worst with this.
I totally hear you. But as far as like people trailing me when I say all the time, because I'm such like a paranoid lunatic about watching all these murder shows all the time, I always think that people are following me to like rape and murder me. So I'll usually like take all these different kinds of shortcuts and stuff and cut around and turn here and turn there just to see if they're like really following.
Well, you shouldn't listen to the Unsolved Mysteries theme song in your car. That might be.
No, I know that doesn't help.
No. no, but you know, you take the smart precautions, and I just feel as though we live in that world. We live in a world where you have to just watch your back a little bit, at least.
One time I was like 16 and I was riding a bicycle because I didn't learn to drive till I was like 26. Long story. But this guy pulls up to me at a stoplight. This is in Merced, California. And he's like, hey, girl, what's up? And I'm like, hi, how's it going? And he's like, why don't you just like pull over here and we'll just chat. Pull over here. And I was like, okay, yeah, totally. Oh, and so he actually pulled into the parking lot and I like hightailed it out of there because I wanted to like get a jump on him because I'm on a bicycle. Yeah. So he gets pissed, like, swerves around and like follows me for a few miles.
Oh my god.
And I'm like going fast. So I actually start going down like streets that are residential just so in case I get like abducted, maybe somebody will be home and looking out their window and see it. And I had to go like every which way. I took the long way back to my apartment. I made sure nobody was following me after that point. And then I like ran upstairs and hid my bike and everything because I was so scared. But I've never had like more adrenaline in my life.
Well, I did research on that story. And what I found out, there's an update. That was the IRC guy.
Oh yeah. My God. 10 years later.
Now, that's a scary story. And of course, I'm glad that you were smart enough at this age to not just go, let's just hang out, you know?
Oh my God, yeah. But like, that's what I'm saying. And I know people are over my feminist rants and I will try and stop soon, but every woman has a story like that.
Yeah. Men are stalked too, but not nearly as much. I'd say 5% versus 95%.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm not trying to take away. Obviously, men can be victims. Men can be raped. Men can be murdered. Like, I'm totally. I'm not trying to take that away. But it just seems like it sure happens a hell of a lot more to women.
Yes, it does. And I'm not gonna. So, yeah, I mean, it's just it's a sad statistic. And anybody who wants to debate that statistic should just kind of go to Google and search for the statistic. No debate.
Exactly. Well, so he tried to do what I did, where he's like trying to duck and weave the cop just to try and get rid of him. He actually ends up in a cul-de-sac because that's just this guy's luck. So
that, honestly, it's like he goes down the alley with a truck backing up. I mean, this guy is really not on point.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe this is some finally karma for him. So he hops out of the car and goes on foot. Now, there is thousands of acres of wilderness and he is just gone. So the Shasta PD guy calls in backup. They do this huge man search. We're talking through rivers, streams, mountains, rocks. It was crazy. They were searching for him. They found a footprint going this way, but then they'd go that way for 2 miles and realize that he had actually gone a different way. He was zigzagging like a alligator was running after him. You know, he was going all over the place.
Now, let me ask you, before this happened, wasn't it when he pulls the police officer pulls him over and he's like, let me see your hands. Let me see your hands. Or did that happen after this?
No, that did happen. He was let me see your hands. And he's like, yeah, no problem.
I thought that was a very tense moment because he's getting out on the other side of the truck. He's like, I'm cool, I'm good, my hands are up. And he just kind of runs off. And it's...
And I watched with the subtitles on, and in brackets, it was tense music. I was like, ooh, what's going to happen?
Yeah. But all in all, I'd say this is the shining star of the episode in the sense of dramatics. It's even better than the Brandon Lee
part. Yeah. And so night falls, and the search is called off. So the next morning, he pops up in this town called Lakehead. It's actually 8 miles south from where he ran away. And there's a very tense scene with a woman where he's like, I want to buy your car. And she's like, you got the cash? Yeah. And she's looking him up and down. So I'm like, creepy. It's so creepy, but are they going to have sex? I didn't know what was going to happen because she was eyeballing him. So he was like, yeah, I'll just follow you in your house. And she's like, you stay back here and I'll go get the keys.
Puts her hand on his chest to push him away. It's a very...
Yeah.
Did you guys hook up outside of this show?
I think they might have, or we're just about to. That's how much chemistry I felt. Yeah. So the next scene we see is him just driving away in that car and supposedly nothing happened to that lady.
We never know. We have no idea.
That was added for us though, because I read and she was supposedly a very elderly woman.
Oh.
And she was unharmed, so she was okay. But they added a little sex appeal for us, I think.
I don't mind it.
No, it was fine, and we need it. We need to break up all this tragedy. So,
by the way, if I could just say, that car looks a lot like one of the. It looks like the same exact car that was used in another reenactment of the child abduction episode with the two friends.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that is the same exact year and model of that car and color. So I'm wondering, is it possible it's the same person's car? Is it the same one? I forgot about that until just now.
The one on the scooter?
Yeah, where they scooter to the grocery store.
That's our next one.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, you're getting people excited, ready to listen to the
I'm sorry. Yeah, it was a back-to-back thing. So when I was watching the other one, I'm like, that's the same car. I'm going to take screenshots. Awesome. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
So then he's actually next seen in Orange County. He's definitely going south. He has family in Orange County and he has family in Mexico. But the last time he has ever seen is in Orange County. And that's kind of the end of the story. They show us his mugshot. They tell us, he has his index fingers chopped off at the knuckle. Mm-hmm. And these are identifying marks. So he's never been seen again, except if you go on unsolved.com, two people think that they might have seen him. Actually, one was in Oregon and one sighting was in Arizona, and that was as late as 2008. So just keep your eyes out.
Yeah, I mean, it's I wonder, do we know how old he would be right now? I don't recall there being an age attached to this guy.
I don't either.
Yeah. But if we're going to guess that it's him, I mean, maybe he's about in his mid-50s now at least.
Yeah, he looked if I'm going off looks for the mugshot, maybe 32.
Yeah, so, and this happened in 1994, so yeah, it's about 26 years ago.
Okay,
about
yeah,
60, maybe 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
So, it, you know, people just, you know, between the age of like 40 and 60, I mean, people are can't even tell who they are anymore.
That's true. But just keep your eyes on that index finger because it is weird. It's all chopped off. So.
Oh, my God.
Not to say it's weird, but you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's a telltale sign.
So now.
Now we get into a little bit of the paranormal. Fun one.
Love it. I love this one. It was really fun.
I thought.
For not for Sammy.
No, no, no. I mean, the Gulf War is way before your time. You were an infant.
Well, I was 10. Yeah.
You know, but this was a big deal. This was, you know, I was like, am I going to get drafted? Because I was 18, you know, and wow. It's one of those things, you know, 1991 is when I graduated high school. And I was like, well, I'm going to college. You know, I think that's one way to keep out of a draft if they ever to reinitiate it. And I had friends who went to, you know, the Gulf War and were, fought in Desert Storm. And it's, you know, it was really crazy. And I've never heard of stories like this where thankfully none of my friends were ever kidnapped. I mean, you know, held hostage POWs. And yeah, POWs. Yeah. But this guy went through some serious stuff. And again, we are dealing with reenactors who are far older than what they should be. This guy's got to be in his like mid to late 30s. Sammy Mubarak.
I love him. He was like,
me too.
I really liked this episode.
I did too. I love this segment. It added, I love these type of truly unexplained phenomenon type of situations. Mm-hmm. But do you want to jump into this? I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I'll just say it wouldn't be Unsolved Mysteries without the unexplained.
Yes.
So I love these. So the first night Baghdad was bombed during the Gulf War, we meet Joe O'Brien from California and he watched it on TV. And he's like an old Air Force guy, and he was really close friends with this man he met named Mohammed Mubarak, who we call Sammy. He goes by Sammy. So he is actually like a Kuwaiti Air Force pilot, and he is on the Kuwait side of the Iraq conflict. So they were friends for 16 years, and he's watching this conflict on TV, and all of a sudden he sees Sammy basically like holding up a newspaper, you know, like as a hostage, and they're showing it on TV. So he's like, oh my God, that's my friend.
By the way, people might not realize that Kuwait was who we were helping.
Yeah.
So, you exactly. know, a lot of people just kind of think, oh, it's, you know, Indians. But yeah, Kuwait was trying to, you know, get freedom, and they were being attacked by the Saudis.
Yes.
So, sorry.
No, please. I think it's important to say. So the Iraqis had actually shot down Sammy's plane and had taken him as a prisoner of war. And Joe's watching this on TV and he's like, oh my God, is my friend of 16 years going to be killed? Yeah. Like, what's going on with Sammy? So he has a fitful night's sleep, as it's referred to in Unsolved Mysteries. And he finally falls asleep and he has a dream. And in the dream, he is a POW. Now, this is Joe we're talking about in his dream. He sees like this prison cell that he's in, and he describes the collars and stuff, and he feels this like severe pain in his hands and in his wrists. And he also sees this like beige and green striped blanket, and he has really like warm, happy feelings about this blanket. He doesn't know why, but this blanket is his friend. So he wakes up in a cold sweat and is like, oh my God, now I know how Sammy must feel, because obviously my friend's a POW. It's on my mind. That's why I had the dream. So he wakes up and his hands and his wrists are all like red and messed up. So he runs them under cold water to kind of, you know, just
to find relief. Make him feel yeah. It's like, because yeah. He's having all of this like wrist pain.
Yeah, and he goes with his friend to another friend to a diner, and he like can't even pick up the coffee cup. His hands are all shaking and injured, and the friend's like, what's that about?
And he tells his friend about the dream.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. And he actually had that pain in his hand for 5 days.
Yeah, I mean, from the way that they were talking about it, it was just, it really had that type of like, he really, really harmed himself. And even the way they showed his hands, they looked painful. Like, they did.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that they really reenacted this well. And we really, I thought everybody was really good. They really got their point across.
Yeah, totally. So, I could not agree more. And it turns out that the Gulf War was a short little war. It was 42 days. Yeah. I'm sure it felt longer to Sammy, but we actually see on TV Saddam Hussein like exchanging POWs with the United States, and we get to see Sammy, and Sammy is alive, and I don't know if I'll say well, but he's alive.
Yeah. You know, it's funny about the Gulf War, because I'm just looking at the dates, and it kind of triggered in my head. When we finally officially went to war with the Gulf War, in the Gulf War, it was August 2nd, 1990. And I remember I had already been accepted to school, and I knew I was going away, and I just felt like I was safe in case of draft. Because I really had this, like, obsession with draft until I aged out.
Well, yeah, that's a scary feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you think like it's never going to happen in your lifetime, then all of a sudden you become exactly the age to be drafted.
Oh, yeah, and you have just no control over it.
But yeah, I mean, it was a very short war. It ended at the end, on the last day of February, February 28th, 1991.
Okay, so a little longer. Maybe this
the well, officially, I mean, that's, you know, the war had ended, but that was like the final, I guess, where they signed the documents. It means nothing, okay. Really.
Well, the next Christmas, we get to see Sammy. Sammy and his sister come to visit Joe and Joe's family in California. So it's like a very happy reunion. Everybody's happy to see each other. And Joe's like, let me tell you something crazy. I had this dream where I was you in prison. And Sammy is like instantly triggered. And Joe is describing the room to a T, and Sammy's like, yeah, that's what my room looked like. And he's describing the blanket and how much he loves the blanket. And Sammy's like, the blanket was the only comfort that I had in this world. Everything else was stripped away from me, but I had warmth from this blanket. And so I bonded with this blanket.
Can you imagine being in a situation like this where you are a POW? You're in this disgusting room, you know, and you have nothing, and you probably think you're going to be killed any minute, and you live through it. You know, it's like you miraculously get through it psychologically, physically, you're home, and you speak to somebody, and it's like you're able to share your horrible experience that maybe you weren't even able to really deal with in a lot of ways, but you're not able to have a shared instance where this person, you know, saw it and kind of and experience some of it. So I like that entire thing. I think there's comfort.
I have like to that. Say that's very optimistic of you, because I was the opposite way. If I'm Sammy and I'm, telling my friend about this experience and he goes, oh my God, I had a dream like that. So me too. Like, we're basically POWs together. I would slap him. Like, I was in there for so long. I was tortured and stuff, and you had, like, one REM cycle worth of experience with me. Like, no, it is not the same thing.
I guess I see what you're saying. It's kind of like climbing a mountain and one person's taking the chopper up. But we're both here! So, but no, I get it. But for him to actually see it, it affected him, clearly. I mean, to the point where he has this story.
It's a trip, too. And the thing about the 5 days with his hands was actually Sammy was kept in handcuffs so tight that it, like, was cutting circulation off to his hands for 5 days. So it's a really cool, creepy, psychic experience that I have no explanation for, skeptical.
And we also don't know why them. There's no real touch upon that. Like, no, they're friends. Buddies. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought this was really special, but I couldn't really find anything on anybody afterwards. I saw a little bit about Sammy's POW experience and interviews that he gave, but I found Joe's like address and phone number and email address. And I Googled his email address, and the only experience I could find on the internet with his email address was a forum that he wrote where he complained. No, it's so
the IRC chat.
No IRC, but he complained about this Google Chrome add-on, and he was like, this is the stupidest thing, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, a few weeks later, he writes this beautiful apology to Google Chrome, because it was actually his fault that something was messing up. And he is like, I apologize. I did not give you a fair chance. It was my fault, not yours. And I'm sure there are many smart men and women working to bring Google to me. So thank you. And I just thought it was so precious. And
like
when do you see that?
Really lets you know maybe he's a pretty halfway decent guy. I mean, that's I mean, you're just writing like a review and you feel bad enough to return.
I know. That's what I was saying. You could easily fade into oblivion and never be seen from again, but you returned to apologize. Like, that is adorable.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. It also scares me when I leave reviews using my real name, because I wonder if people were to Google my name in 25, 35 years, mm-hmm. is that what they're going to find is my Yelp review for, you know, a sushi place?
Yeah, that's your legacy.
All I could find is that he seemed to eat a lot of sushi. That's my legacy's Yelp reviews on about sushi. So, but I will not really put reviews out there in my own name.
Okay.
Unless it's for Walls Bakery, which is in Hewlett, New York, for their chocolate pudding babka, which I purchased the other day and was delicious.
I've heard stories of this babka, and I would like
it. It's not bad. I would ship it, but I don't think it's really shippable.
Yeah, no, that sounds perishable in the heat down here.
Pretty crumbly. But, Kim, thank you so much for getting together today. This was, as always, it's the highlight of my day. It's really just a wonderful, I love the episodes that we're recording. I think that Unsolved Mysteries Rewind is such a worthwhile project. And I have to thank you so much for coming up with the idea in the first place.
Oh my gosh, the pleasure is all mine. I love doing these. I love interacting with the people on our Facebook page, and it's just a fun time.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.